Hello, I'm Robert Washburn, and welcome to Consider This Northumberland, a current affairs program dedicated to the issues facing our community. We talk to the people on the front lines and those behind the scenes who make a difference in your life and Northumberland County. So I'm asking you, the listener, to take some time out of your busy day to consider this. So far in the series on opioids in Northumberland, we have heard from law enforcement and the role they play on the front lines. Today, we are about to hear more from those in the field dealing with this issue directly. It would be hard to imagine anyone who sees the impact more than doctors and addiction counselors. They experience firsthand the horrific consequences of opioid overdoses and addictions. And while there may be some who can pull back from the edge, there are those who do not make it. They know the effects of these drugs on individuals, but also on family and friends and the community. We're going to hear those stories and more on this show. I'm pleased to welcome Dr. Peter Barnett, Medical Chief of Northumberland Hills Hospital Emergency Department, and Jennifer Cox, Integrated Director for Northumberland Hills Hospital Community Mental Health and Addiction Services. Welcome and thank you for being here.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I want to begin by asking each of you how you would describe the situation with opioids within Northumberland County. How about Jennifer, you go first.
So the situation in Northumberland County, I think, is something, you know, at our clinic, I work at the Northumberland Hills Hospital, the Community Mental Health Clinic, and we offer naloxone kits at that clinic. And we see people out in the community every day, live in their lives, whether they live, some people are living on the street, we see people in their apartments, we also see people who come to the clinic through our walk-in or through our outreach. So I think that, you know, we're trying to get involved in how people live their lives every day, and some of those folks are struggling with addiction for sure.
Peter, how would you describe it?
I think in a word, it's a tenuous situation that we're dealing with right now. It's not a matter of recreational drug use or the happenstance of drug use. This is a level of use that is epidemic in nature. It's also dealing with a type of drug that is so potent and deadly that there is very little wiggle room for anything but a very aggressive approach.
What is it that you see day in and day out when you're working in the emergency? What kinds of things come across your desk or in your experience as you're trying to deal with this day to day?
You know, there's a stereotypical image that people may have about the drug user. A certain image may come to mind when people think about who is actually using and abusing these opioids. And I can tell you, it is not what you think. It is all ages, all backgrounds, all professions, all socioeconomic layers. The problem is universal across the social strata. And I think that's something that may shock a lot of people, especially your listeners, when they think about who's actually using these opioids on the street.
Would you describe it as a crisis at this point?
Absolutely. I think fortunately, because we are a small town, we're insulated a little bit from the problems that the bigger cities are seeing. But that does not mean that we're not seeing our own tragedies in the emergency department, in the mental health resource areas. And the problem is not going away anytime soon.
Jennifer, the people that you see day in and day out, Peter described in a certain way. What's been your experience? How would you describe the people who are coming in, day out?
I think it's important, you know, what Peter is talking about, it's important to know that the typical stereotype that people have around folks who have a mental illness or an addiction or struggling with both are not what the typical stereotype that people will come up with. These are people that, you know, mental illness and addiction knows no boundaries. It crosses all socioeconomic barriers, it crosses all cultural, ethnicity, or other barriers that we may think, you know, protect or insulate people from addiction or mental illness. Those things cross all barriers. So we know that though it's not, no one is insulated from it or protected necessarily.
How does that then affect the way that both your groups respond to what's going on in the community? Because if we're not thinking in stereotypical terms, how then, you know, usually we classify people or we can sort of dismiss them, oh, that's that group there, it's the other that is in trouble. Whereas what you're telling me is there are no others. It's people across the board and people like us, our listeners, those of us who are sitting here. How does that change your perspective in how you treat these people?
I think one of the biggest challenges it presents to us is connecting people to treatment resources. A lot of people that are insulated in their lives, either professionally or from a certain educational background, who feel like they don't have any access to treatment because then they would have their problem known to the public, and that scares the heck out of them. And so they don't readily look for a treatment. And so when they come into the emergency department and we have this encounter, it's very difficult to try to get through that fear, to actually set them up for resources for both treatment and for further prevention of any other harm.
Jennifer?
So I agree, and I think that a lot of times people who have mental illness and addiction, what happens is it creates a fear, right? When the onset of a mental illness is very scary for people. And so what ends up happening is people who struggle with mental illness and addiction, which is what we would call concurrent disorder, who have both, right? Imagine if you have a mental illness and now on top of that you struggle with an addiction. So those folks often don't present for help. They're fearful of presenting to their family physician or going to the emergency department or presenting to formalized help, fear of stigma, fear of judgment. And so those folks will wait till the last possible minute or last possible second that it's no longer their choice at times to present for help. So things like what Peter's saying, connecting to outreach services, or I would say that, you know, from our perspective at the clinic, we take what's called a harm reduction approach, which instead of, you know, historically our field has sometimes treated individuals with addiction or mental illness in a punitive manner, and so we've removed privileges from people who struggle with these illnesses. But harm reduction instead takes a compassionate approach, right, and trying to understand where the person's at, meeting them where they're at in their recovery, and working with them from that point. No one comes into life and chooses to have an addiction or to have a mental illness or to have both. No one chooses those things. But historically, I think sometimes we have that sense of, well, that's happened to that person from a series of bad choices, which is not the case.
And it would seem to me, too, that, I mean, in your particular position, you're meeting people at a very high crisis level. In other words, as you've described, these are last resorts. They've obviously done something to themselves that brought themselves that they have to go to the emergency department, or they're at a particular point in their lives where it's not the first thing. It's probably maybe the last thing that they would have expected to do. So, can you help us understand what it's like when people are coming through to you in that sort of crisis mode, to be able to address something as serious as an opioid addiction?
I think first off, Jennifer paints a very good picture of what we're up against in the realm of addiction. I think also to characterize the typical emergency department encounter, it is literally a matter of life and death. We're dealing with an overdose that shuts down the brain, shuts down the respiratory drive. People literally are dying when they come in. If we have the opportunity and the availability to actually resuscitate them and to reverse the effect of the opioid, that uncovers very painful undercoat of both social stigma, of psychological illness, of physiological illness, and it can even hint towards some social ills that maybe push the person towards the addiction in the first place. And so the actual medicine part of this is a very small slice of it. The issue of addiction and treatment afterwards is huge. And I think that's why allies like Jennifer are so important in the full scheme of our treatment regimen.
Before we go too much further, maybe we should get some of our terms clear. Peter, maybe you'd be best to handle this one. Is what is an opioid?
Okay, so that's a good question. Let's characterize this, because there are a lot of different drugs that people can pick up off the street. Opioids themselves, they belong to a certain family of medications or pharmacological substances that are specifically used in the legitimate sense and in the medical sense to treat pain. That's pretty much all they do. They block the pain receptors in your body, so your brain does not perceive the pain, even though the body's injury, let's say a broken bone, still is causing pain and it's still a broken bone. These medications block the pain receptors, so the brain doesn't recognize the pain. Some of the pain medications that we talk about, these opioids, they have a weak effect. They can take a little bit of the pain away. Some are very, very strong. And not only do they take the pain away, but they also create a sense of euphoria. And that's where the addiction problem comes into play.
Now, we hear certain terms used. We hear codeine, heroin, fentanyl, carfentanil. What are those particular things? How do they fit under the umbrella of opioids?
So I guess the mother of all these medications would be heroin, which comes from the opium plant, the poppy plant. That's the raw state of a narcotic. And since the use of these medications thousands of years ago by different civilizations, coming into the modern age, scientists were able to synthesize these medications and make them artificially or synthetically instead of using the raw materials from the opioid plant or the opium plant. In the process of doing that, they've been able to synthesize these medications to the point where they're very concentrated and very powerful. So we have weak synthetic opioids like codeine, which do a decent job for taking care of the kind of pain that someone would get from, let's say, a very bad sprain or a broken bone, to the point or to the medication of something like fentanyl, which is actually used as part of an anesthetic regimen. That's how powerful it is. Along the way, we have medications such as morphine and synthetic forms of morphine called hydromorphone, which are very strong medications. But I think it's really important to keep in perspective that the power of a medication like fentanyl is several thousand times the strength of morphine, which gives you an idea of just how dangerous this is on the street.
Now, when doctors prescribe these kinds of medications, as you describe, for certain kinds of things, how is it then that somebody becomes addicted to this? Is there a medical description for how this takes place?
There's a whole science actually that's dedicated to the study of addiction, and I know Jennifer could speak volumes about this as well from her perspective, from the behavioral health treatment aspect of it. Not to get too down in the weeds, what these medications do, they create the sense of euphoria, and it triggers certain reward pathways in the brain. If you think about the brain as reacting and sensing the environment using these different chemicals in the brain, when these opioids are taken, some of them are so strong that they activate this reward center, which creates a craving. And the craving is very hard to keep up with. Users will continue to use more powerful and increasing doses of the opioid to satisfy that craving to the point where it puts them in danger of overdose. And they're not choosing to overdose. They're just choosing to try to meet that hunger that they have.
Jennifer, is there something you'd like to add to this, maybe a perspective or a dimension?
When Peter's chatting, two things kind of come to my mind, and one is the blocking of pain. And I think that that's important for people to understand. You know, we wrap our heads around physical pain, and people who live in chronic pain, there's lots of ends that people will go to end chronic pain, to stop a pain that has not been relieved, right? So the same is true of people who have mental illness and addiction. They experience pain in the same way that we can think about somebody having physical pain from an injury or from something that's happened in their life. Mental illness and addiction create pain in people's lives, and so it makes some sense when people are trying to block pain, right? It makes sense in my brain, at least, about why people would turn to that. The other thing that we often hear, Peter's right on, the thing that we often hear from folks is that, you know, after the first time that they have used a drug, like an opioid, that first high that is created never gets created again, and there's a chasing to get that again. There's a craving or a drive from their body to need that again, to have that again. Imagine the best feeling that you've ever had in your life and amplify it by maybe 100 times. Lots of people would want that again.
You wanted to add something, Peter?
If I could, please. I think Jennifer brings up an excellent point about the pain that people feel from the mental health side of their lives. When we have the opportunity to speak with people after a successful resuscitation, and I say that word meaning that somebody has come in dying from an opioid overdose, and we're actually able to reverse it and save their life, we have a chance to talk. And the stories that people tell, first of all, everybody has a very unique story. There is no blanket cause to addiction. There is no blanket approach to treating an addiction. Everybody has their own story. And to sit and listen with somebody who can tell their story, it will break your heart. A lot of people that use these drugs illicitly are self-medicating because they have so much pain in their lives that they have found really nothing else to help assuage that pain except these extreme measures. And that opens up a whole different talk about how do we treat people with severe mental health issues in the community.
How does that get into? I'm not asking this properly, but I'm so fascinated by the stories of these people because we really don't know the stories. I mean, you talk to them when you're dealing with them in the emergency department. Can you share with us a story that to you seems maybe typical or helps us better understand the kinds of people without identifying anybody? Because I know the privacy is important, but can you share a story with us that might paint a picture that the listeners can better understand the type of person that you deal with in these situations?
Yes, thank you. Actually, this is an excellent opportunity to kind of loop around and talk about the stereotype that people may have about who a drug user or drug abuser is. So this is a story about a 26-year-old male. He had been in a very successful construction business with his father, and his life was on track. He had a great business. He had a great family. He was getting married. Everything was working out really well for him. And then he was hit by a drunk driver on the 401 when he was driving out of Toronto one night. He was injured so severely that he was in the ICU for about 3 months, learning how to walk again, learning how to eat again. He was completely, well, for lack of a better word, he was completely destroyed by this accident. Now, through the course of his treatment, he had such severe pain that he was using very high doses of narcotics or opioids to keep the pain under control. Unfortunately, when he recovered physically from all of his injuries, he had developed an addiction to the opioids, and he carried that burden with him when he left the hospital. He kept on going back to his doctor, complaining about the chronic pain that he had from the injuries, but eventually his doctor cut him off from any further opioid prescriptions because the doctor was worried about him developing addiction. Unfortunately, it was too late. He was already addicted. And so with his source of supply cut off from legitimate means through prescriptions and pharmacies, he resorted to satisfying his needs off the street. And so he started buying pills off the street. Now, eventually that became too expensive for him. And so he had to start buying heroin off the street and injecting it. And his life fell apart from there. He lost his family, he lost his fiance, he lost his business. He was living on the street. And the reason why he actually came into our hospital is because he developed a really bad infection in his arm when he was injecting heroin with a dirty needle. And so in the course of treating the infection, he opened up and he just laid his life out for me. And I have to tell you, it's a privilege for someone to have that trust in myself or another doctor or a mental health provider, that they can actually feel so comfortable and feel so safe that they can lay their life out for us, especially the tragedy. But it also paints a very, very accurate picture of how these addictions develop. It isn't just recreational. A lot of these are unintentional problems that come off of prior medical treatments.
Jennifer, how about from your experience, from your perspective, can you share with us maybe some stories, some anecdotes of the people that you've met and you've tried to help?
Yeah, sure. There's so many to think about, too, and trying to keep some of the stories a little bit vague to not identify folks. I'm thinking particularly of a young lady that we've seen through a course of a number of years actually struggle with her addiction. She struggled with her addiction from being a teenager, quite young actually, and hid that very well from anybody who was involved in her life, including parents who were very well-intended people, really, you know, educated, employed, for all intents and purposes. Nobody would look twice at their house. Everybody would drive by and think, oh, that's a family that just lives there. That's the so-and-sos. We know them. We meet them on Sundays in the backyard. So she struggled for a number of years throughout all of school with their addiction and hid it quite successfully, or unsuccessfully, I suppose. She, once the addiction was visible to those around her, it was now very entrenched. This was no longer a choice. It's not a choice that she was making. She was actively using every day, multiple times a day, to satisfy the need that her body had. By the time that this is now visible to everyone around her, she's now out of school, out of a job, and her family has now walked away from the situation after multiple attempts to try to help her. So the thing about addiction, Peter mentioned loss. right? The thing about addiction and mental illness is that loss is the common underlying denominator across the entire lifespan. So everything that you think about in your life, unlike another illness, you know, if you think about other physical illnesses that Peter can talk a lot, I'm sure he has a breadth of knowledge about this. You know, they might affect, we might be able to isolate them to an area of our life that has to be managed to understand that illness. Mental illness and addiction will cross all the boundaries in your life, remove all of the supports and reliable things that you have in your life. So she had lost everything. She was then living on the street. She had gone from living in a well-established house to now living on the street to couch surfing at best of times. That was the best that she could pull together. She had multiple treatment opportunities. And she had really felt given up or abandoned by a system. She felt mistrustful of the system. And she was a person that otherwise would have lived her life like you or I, any of us would have. I'm happy to say that, you know, through the hospital, we take what's called a harm reduction approach, right? We are part of a larger network in this county. It's certainly not doing it by ourselves. This is not something that any one organization can do on their own. And it's, you know, wrapping around that person to meet them every day where they're at in that recovery. Whether it's today, instead of using 5 times, I'm going to use 4 times. So there we are, trying to help them through that, right? And so each day, that's the approach. Happy to say that after a significant battle, probably 10 years, that this person is in recovery. So it is, and she has a life ahead of her now, and a life that is now has an education to it that she didn't count on having, for sure.
How does it impact you when you sit across from people like this, when you work with people like this, especially for that long of time? How does it impact you?
So I think, you know, Peter said it's such a privilege, and he's so right about that. We have the privilege of people who otherwise will let no one in, who feel abandoned by most people, to let us into their worst moment, to let us in and have some visibility to their worst moment, their worst day. You know, most of us go through life trying to patch up or cover up for others or for the world the dark spots about ourselves we don't really like. Right, we do that every day. All of us do that every day. That's a normal part of life. For folks who have a mental illness and addiction, that working to cover that up or withdraw is a significant piece of their existence. That's how they get through most days. And so if somebody is letting us in and revealing those spots or those pieces that they feel very shameful about, it is a privilege for us.
Peter, you're nodding your head.
I am. You know, for myself and my perspective, it's like we're looking into the abyss. I don't understand, if I speak for myself, I don't understand how hard someone's life can be until I speak with somebody who is struggling with addiction. Not using drugs, struggling with addiction. That's really what it comes down to. The use of the drug is that's the side effect of the struggle that the person is going through. And you have a sense of looking in somebody's humanity and just trying to fathom the depth of pain that person is dealing with on a daily basis. You wake up with it, you go to sleep with it. If you can sleep, you go to sleep with it. And then you meet their family members and you understand the enormity of the love they have for that person in their life that has the addiction, and the depth of empathy and compassion. And just when you think you understand humanity, it really gives you a gut check.
Mm-hmm. Well, on that note, we're gonna take a break for some commercials, and I'm going to be continuing to talk to Dr. Peter Burnett, medical chief of the Northumberland Hills Hospital Emergency Department, and Jennifer Cox, the integrated director of the Northumberland Hills Community Mental Health and Addiction Services, about opioids in Northumberland County. Please stay tuned to Consider This on Northumberland 89.7 FM, your truly local source for news. We'll be right back. Hello and welcome back. This is Consider This Northumberland, and I'm your host, Robert Washburn. And you are listening to Northumberland 89.7 FM. My guests today are Dr. Peter Burnett, medical chief of the Northumberland Hills Hospital Emergency Department, and Jennifer Cox, the integrated director for Northumberland Hills Hospital Community and Mental Health and Addiction Services. And we are talking about opioids. Before the break, we were talking about how this impacts you, but
The volume, too, is rather incredible. I know that, for example, the Public Health Ontario tracks the number of visits to the emergency department. And in 2018, just at the end of last year, there were 21 cases at that point through that quarter. Do you have any other statistics that you can share with us about the level of service over the last little while, whether it's going up or down, or what you see?
Unfortunately, the trend is going upwards, and it's been going upwards over the past 10 years. When we study statistics and analyze the trends, we're doing it from an epidemiological standpoint. And one thing I'd really like to get across to your listeners is that we are not law enforcement. We are not tracking people for law enforcement needs or for crime statistics. This is simply to try to project what the trends in certain diseases are and how to allocate resources to meet those needs. Unfortunately, though, we are still seeing an upward tick. Unfortunately, the drugs that are being used are so much more potent than simple heroin and simple oxycodone pills that are being taken off the street. We're dealing with medications such as fentanyl and carfentanyl, which are 1,000 to 10,000 times as strong as morphine. So the single use, it has the potential of literally killing somebody before they even ingest the total dose, which also raises the risk of contamination to the first responders, the police and the paramedics that respond to these emergencies. They run the risk of contamination also. I'm sorry I got a little off the track with the statistics there, but we at least over the past year are seeing at least one overdose per week in our hospital.
Wow. One overdose a week. Now, how many deaths there have been at the hospital?
I don't know the stats for how many deaths we've experienced at the hospital, but I can tell you that one death is way too many. I think okay. That's really all I can say about the mortality rate.
All right. Just so that our listeners know, the Halliburton Kawartha of Pine Ridge District Health Unit had recorded just in the quarter between July and October of 2018, four deaths within their region, which is not just Northumberland, but also includes Lindsay and Halliburton. But all the same, you're right, one death is far too many. From statistics of the people that you serve, Jennifer, how many people are you treating at this point that have opioid-related cases?
So it wouldn't be something that we would track on its own. I can track, you know, the number of folks that are coming through the clinic and that are accessing our services. We tend to do somewhere in the neighborhood of 33,000 visits a year throughout the county. So we are a busy team for sure. And so folks can come in contact with the number of our teams. We have a number of different services. For example, I think it's important, Peter's raised a point around for us to meet people where they're at and to meet them at their worst times, they have to have an element, we're asking them to have an element of trust in us and invest an element of trust in us. And so for them to do that, they have to have a sense that, you know, we are coming at them from a helper perspective, which is our role, right? Our role is, you know, to get out where they are in the community and to provide that compassion and support and help in a way. Right, and so to do that is, you know, for them to feel that there's not a reporting requirement that's going to penalize them in any way. And so we try to do things like remove barriers for help, remove the barriers that they perceive maybe in their way to getting the help that they need. One of the things that we've tried to do is to launch a walk-in clinic with partners, right, to just be available when people need us, rather than, you know, the traditional format of, well, you have to call us and book an appointment and then we'll fit you in. We just want to be open, and if you come in, we'll see you. And so since we've done that, we launched an expansion in March to younger people, because we know there are lots of young folks that live in the county that don't have the support they need. So since March of 19, we've had 585 folks through the clinic that offers that 2 days a week. So those types of numbers tell me that there's a greater need out there for folks to have the access to help without the barrier, right? But mental illness and addiction create so many barriers in their lives by removing resources from them. And so if we can reduce some of that and just make it accessible to people, what that tells me is people will come for the help.
But also, aren't these statistics significant in our ability to look at the community and say, what do we, that we have a problem or that we have a crisis? I appreciate the fact that, you know, people don't want to feel that they're being counted, but that at the same time, you know, to be able to understand the issue as a community as a whole and be able to respond and to have the resources put to something, we, I guess, obviously have to track it.
Yeah.
So that that we know. I wanted to ask you, Peter, when we talking about opioids, we can't forget the fact that doctors prescribe these drugs for various reasons. If we know there's a potential for an addiction, why do doctors still prescribe them then?
That's an excellent question, and I think that raises the double-edged sword of what we use these medications for. So somebody that has severe pain, you don't want the person suffering in pain, and so you use these medications. But there's been a lot of, I want to say, miseducation over the past 20, 30 years concerning the use of opioid medications in the clinical sense. I remember when I was in medical school and the makers of the medication, oxycodone, they were teaching, and this was being purported from the doctors that had in their service, that it was very difficult to become addicted to oxycodone. There was not a whole lot of understanding about addiction and addiction science back then. And since the onset of the opioid epidemic, we've learned so much more. But we've also learned that the use of opioids clinically is a double-edged sword. You have to use it to control pain, but you also have to be very careful because of the addictive quality of these medications. So it's a very fine line that we try to negotiate every time we have a patient that requires pain control.
And I guess that, what's the role then for the patient? I mean, people, I'm sure, are listening and they're saying to themselves, you know, oh, gee, I was in to see the doctor and wrote me a prescription and, oh, I looked and it was OxyContin. And, you know, how, what is it that as a patient we should be coming in and doing to be better able to have a conversation with our doctor about how to manage the pain properly without running the risk of becoming addicted?
Again, that was an excellent question. I think the biggest thing that we can do as physicians as we speak with our patients is to really understand the nature of the pain that they are experiencing. Now, a lot of times people will come in and say, I have these pain pills, I'm taking them, and they're not helping. That's a good indication that the pain is not controlled by these meds, so stop taking those meds because they can't do anything more for you, and then you start running the risk of them actually causing harm. It's important for the physicians to really understand the quality and the character of the pain that we're treating, and to use the minimum dose of the medication that's effective in controlling that pain for the shortest amount of time possible. And that is the crux or the burden that the physician has to carry.
Last month, Global News did a four-part series on the pharmaceutical industry and what they say is the hold it has on Canada's healthcare system, suggesting that drug manufacturers sway doctors' opinions and ultimately affect the type of drugs that we are prescribed. From your experience, is that true?
I think it depends on the type of practice and the specialty that the pharmacies are approaching. My specialty is emergency medicine. There are only a handful of medications that we use in the emergency sense, and most of those medications have been around for a very long time. So there's not a whole lot of room that a pharmacy rep can come in and say, hey, try this new drug. It's going to be better than anything else you've used, because we already have a stable of medications that we know are tried and proven. Now, switch that environment then to a private clinic or somebody's office where they are using new medications and novel approaches to treating stuff like hypertension. Let's say they have a new medication that comes out that can treat the treat the condition better at less of a cost, less of a pharmaceutical burden to the patient. Those kinds of sale pitches can have an effect on that kind of a practitioner. And so I can't say that the pharmacy as an entity, the pharmaceutical industry doesn't have some influence on particular doctors.
When we look at how you treat people with opioid addictions, we've been talking about new drugs and new approaches. What changes have you seen over the years in terms of treating people with addictions and mental illness? Are you seeing different approaches now that the crisis has been around for a while and different approaches? You talked earlier about harm reduction, but what have you seen in terms of the evolution of approaches to dealing with addicts to opioids?
Mm-hmm. So when I first started out just over 20 years ago, I would say that at that time it was really mental illness and addiction were understood very separately, and they were always treated very separately. And folks, we know, struggle with both. But the approach or the treatment approaches weren't integrated very well. And so what I'm happy to say is over the years, that has changed dramatically. So now you're seeing mental illness and addiction as co-occurring specialties on most community mental health organizations and addiction organizations, because we're understanding, and most treatment centers now understand, that folks are coming in with an addiction, they likely have a co-occurring mental illness. And so we're seeing treatment centers where people go for addiction treatment also starting to integrate those things a little bit more so. We are also seeing a more of a spectrum, if you will, of treatment options. So we used to just see folks being referred for abstinence was considered 20 years ago as kind of the gold standard or the way to go. That was the main choice that people would be offered. So they would be offered abstinence-related treatments. Now we understand, and there's a lot more acceptance of harm reduction. It has taken some time, and I would say some research behind it to demonstrate its impact. And it's difficult, you know, we are all in a healthcare profession, we're helpers, and that concept of a harm reduction approach at first can seem somewhat contrary to what we've come into the field to do. So it can be very challenging for some when we're first starting out. But having been on the front lines and watched the harm reduction approach and see people embrace, it's a compassion approach. It's meeting people where they're at, for example, right? Today I'm going to use 5 times, but tomorrow I'm going to use 4. Right? Or when I use, instead of using with the folks that are also using to the same degree as me, I'm going to now go to a different group of folks that I know aren't using today, and so I know I'll be safer. So it's all kinds of choices that people are making to help reduce the impact of that the addiction has on them. And then also in doing so, opening them up to treating the mental illness, which potentially wasn't the case before. We used to say you had to treat one or the other first, but now we're treating both together because it's a whole person. So it's a much more comprehensive, a much more integrated approach.
Both of you have alluded to this, but I'd like to talk about it specifically, and that is how the two arms of the hospital work together to help people. And both of you have sort of talked a little bit about this, but I want to talk specifically because I would think in the past, things were very separate, very siloed. Mm-hmm. And now both of you have alluded that there is more communication. So can you describe to me, for example, somebody comes into the emergency department, how do the two aspects of the hospital work together to help that individual? Maybe we'll start with you, Peter.
Sure. I think that's a credit to what Jennifer's talking about before, about that holistic approach. I think we learned from the past organizationally that stovepiping our organization does not help. It really impedes good patient care, it impedes communication, and it impedes handoff to when we transition people from the inpatient side of the hospital to the outpatient side for services and treatment. If my ideal for the emergency department, if people could see us as a portal, people come in, and our job as emergency physicians is to figure out whether the person, first of all, needs to stay in the hospital for inpatient treatment or if they can be safely discharged for outpatient treatment. Part of that, in the sense of addiction, is finding out where the person is at in their, I guess, their willingness to start engaging in treatment, and the willingness of the person to engage with a therapist in the community. Once the medical side of things is taken care of, we can actually say that somebody is safe for discharge. We get them in touch with addiction counselors, and the staff at Jennifer's agency picks up the patient care from where we leave off and puts them on the road for recovery.
Describe from your perspective then, Jennifer.
Yeah, and I think that Peter's exactly right. A portal is a great way to describe it. So, you know, whereas when I first started out in the field, it was, you know, you went somewhere and somebody wrote out a referral for you and gave it to you or sent it off to the next service, right? And then it was up to us to receive that fax and to pick up that referral, connect to the client, and there was a huge lag time in that. And it wasn't very client-centered at all. And to me, what it is putting the burden of navigating a system onto the client. When we are the navigators of the system, that should be on us to take on. So what we have now is a much more integrated system. We have mental health and addictions professionals in the department. So Peter has staff in the department that work with us that are our mental health and addiction staffing, and they also work with some of our partners, and they're in the department to connect with people at that moment. Because what we know is at that moment, when they're divulging and sharing their pain with Peter or sharing their stories or the parts of their lives that they would like to keep hidden, that's when we need to connect with them in that moment, not 3 days, 3 weeks, or 5 days later. We need to connect with them at that moment. So having the staff in the department has been really critical, I would say, and integrated and allowed, you know, the nurses and all the other physicians that work in the department to know who we are and us to know who they are and work as in a much more collaborative way.
So in this context, then, what is the role of the physician then in terms of dealing with the opioid crisis, as we talked about earlier? What do you see the role of a physician being, Peter?
I think the first role is the at least in my sense as being an emergency medicine physician, is to save lives. So the patient that comes in who has overdosed and who is dying because of the overdose, we resuscitate that person. Once we accomplish that, we do something called a medical clearance, which is to look and see if there's anything else going on in that person's health because of the addiction or because of the most recent overdose. If that person is gravely ill because of the overdose, that person will be admitted to the hospital and treated. If the person recovers well while they're still in the emergency department, then that opens the door for us to start addressing use and treatment. And like Jennifer said, we want to take advantage of that momentum. If a person is ready to engage in treatment, if they're ready to really build a rapport with a local resource, we want to be able to get that person in touch with the resource quickly. We don't want them falling back into the dark place where they start using again, they start feeling hopeless that they don't have any other choices.
Jennifer, what's the role of mental health services, addiction services, as you see it?
So our role is to connect to people where they're at. So whether that's in the emergency department, whether it is in their homes, on the streets throughout the county. So we have a number of outreach teams that work out of that are not office-based, because we know that office-based is not necessarily the answer for everybody. Our role is to meet people where they're at, to connect them to not just us, but to the larger service network that's available, and to offer them any supports that we have available to them, which could be psychiatry, counseling, case management, meeting them at the corner of the street where they might be staying, meeting them in their apartment, helping them get connected to primary care. These are a lot of folks that don't have a family physician or a family doctor to help manage any of their medical needs, housing. So it's connecting to the larger social network in the county. We are one arm of that whole net, really.
Now, I understand in the emergency department now, there just recently was announced that naloxone kits are now available for free in the emergency mm-hmm. department. Can you tell us a bit about that initiative and why it's significant?
Absolutely. So the medication itself, naloxone, is the antidote for an opioid overdose. If you think about the opioids grabbing onto these chemical sites on the nerves and stopping and blocking pain signals, and then ultimately when they take too much, that opioid will shut down the brain and shut down the breathing. Naloxone kicks off that drug and opens up those nerve sites to get the brain working again, to get the person breathing again. It actually works very quickly, and it has a relatively safe profile for use as well. And so when we talk about life-saving drugs, this is in and by itself a life-saving drug. The medication in the past was very hard to get a hold of. It usually was only found in a hospital setting or in an ambulance. But once we recognized that people didn't have time because of these overdoses to wait for an ambulance or wait to be driven to an emergency department, you always look at the risk and benefit of anything in medicine, and we found that naloxone has a lot of benefit compared to the risk of its use. And so in that sense, the province has initiated this program where we can actually distribute naloxone medication to people in need in the emergency department. And we have a ready-made kit, and it comes in a little case that is administered via a nasal spray. All the person has to do is put it in the overdosed patient's nose and squish the plunger, and you've saved a life. And that's a pretty wonderful thing.
One of the things that we've seen with this, and I just saw an article recently in the Atlantic magazine about this, is that some people are now using this as a near-death experience, that they're pushing harder and harder, and they're then administering the naloxone just to see if how long they can last in that state, which would concern a lot of people. And also, when we had the police here, Officer Salisbury was talking about going into places and seeing multiple naloxone kits, and that this was something that they did administer themselves. How do you respond to that use of such an amazing drug?
I have to tell you, it's very frustrating. You know, it seems like we're in an arms race. You know, the addiction epidemic shows one face. We meet it with a countermeasure, and the ante gets upped, and we try to counter it with something else. And it just seems like we're kind of locked in the struggle to try to get on top of this epidemic. It's extremely frustrating to me to hear stories about the users who are pushing the envelope, so to speak, with this kind of medication and having the availability of naloxone to save them when they get in a tight spot. Unfortunately, I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about the use of naloxone out there, and I think we could probably touch on that in a bit. But in a word, it is very frustrating to me.
So maybe now's a good time to have that word.
Oh, okay. So naloxone in and of itself is, you know, we look at the risk and benefit. The benefit is saving a life. The risk of not using it is losing a life. You can see, you know, obviously there's a benefit in using it. However, the way people mix drugs in co-ingestions, and for an example, people that may mix methamphetamine with an opioid, and so you have the upper balance by the depressant, and then they overdose in that sense. You know, they can take the naloxone, which will block the effect of the opioid, but now they have an unblocked, full-on intoxication with the methamphetamine, which can cause all sorts of problems with the heart. And so now, instead of having a respiratory problem with a drug overdose, now they have a cardiac problem with an overdose. And so there's a false sense of security in people who don't understand the use of naloxone. And I'm worried that they may lead to more complications down the line.
One of the things that, when I've talked to people about the opioid situation in Northumberland, is that the community needs to come together to start to address the situation. Jennifer, how do you think, as a community, we should move forward?
I think there's a number of, you know, treating an issue like addiction and mental illness is not through one lens. It never could be through just one lens. I think that, you know, everybody has something to offer. Probably the biggest thing is to reduce some of the stigma and judgment that is experienced by people who are experiencing these issues, right? Because otherwise, folks will continue to hide in their apartments, and we will continue to go into apartments and find people who have unfortunately experienced overdoses, whether they've had naloxone kits or not available to them. You know, one thing I think about is when you said that story, it reminded me, the thought that came into my head was, you know, some of our folks who are taking the naloxone kit are taking it because they understand the addiction creates a risk of them dying. And so the naloxone is, I don't want to die, but I have to use this drug, and so I don't want to die. And so when we find them, the naloxone kit is a signal that they didn't want to die. So I think that's a very different statement, right, to try to hold that perspective. So if we think about all of the facets that are involved in all of our lives, those are the same things that people who have mental illness and addiction need. Things like primary care, access to medical care, access to affordable, safe, decent housing, access to an income that affords them the basic needs of life, right? Access to social supports that are not just formal, like coming to see us, but also other supports that you and I would probably take for granted, that we might have plans tomorrow to go visit friends, or we just have people that family that drop in on us. All of those things that you and I take for granted, all of those facets of our life, are all required to support a person. So it's a larger, it's a more integrated approach.
Peter, what would you add to that?
Well, first of all, I think that was a terrific response. I don't know if I could add anything to explain it even better, but I think from my own perspective, we have the benefit of being not just a town, we're a small community, we are a community, and that's our strength in all this. You know, in a word, love your kids, and love your neighbors. This is not a choice, this is not a bad habit, this is not a social stigma, this is a disease, and the disease needs to be treated, and we have the means to treat it. I think I would like to see people to understand that distinction, that it's not just a habit and it's not just a bad choice, that it is a disease that we are working on. And if the people of this community could support their police and support their paramedics, support us in the hospital, support their neighbors, we'll pull through this.
I was going to ask who should be at the table to do this, and you just gave a really good list of who should be aware. But in terms of a response from the institutional community, who do you think needs to get around a table and start to address the opioid situation in Northumberland?
Would you like to take that one?
Sure. So I think we are a community. That's the beautiful part about being in this area, right? And I think, you know, it's going to take people, it's going to take folks like a hospital setting, like addictions treatment centers, like addictions community organizations, like housing organizations, like income organizations. Primary care is going to be a significant, primary care being family physicians, right? So this is going to be a cross-sector approach. It's not in schools, for example, right? So we're not, I don't think that there's any institution really that wouldn't be impacted by should be at this table, right? All of the institutions that we have in this community are aware of what's going on. They're impacted in some way because the folks that have struggled with this might be at school at some point. They might have part-time jobs. They might be attending a faith group. Right, so, and they might be coming to a walk-in clinic because they have an infection. So there's a cross-sector. I think we shouldn't just think about it in terms of just the formalized helpers. I think people with lived experience should also be at that table.
Peter, what would you suggest?
I think on the community level, there's such a huge importance for education. Because the general population does have the stereotypical thoughts about who is an addict and what the addict uses and abuses, if we could achieve a level of education in this town that has just broken down all the barriers and the stereotypes so people understand truly what we're up against, to really drive home the points of community fabric and mutual support, whether that be support groups, whether it be sponsored at the hospital, conversations with police on the street corner, paramedics as they visit your house. I know in the emergency department, when we notice a trend in somebody in the healthcare, we start screening for it at triage. I think this community needs to have an event like that where we can actually triage people in the community. Invest yourselves in your children's lives. Invest yourselves in your loved ones' lives. Don't make the assumptions that, well, they have a job and they have an education, they can't be an addict. It like Jennifer said, it crosses all social strata. And so the big impetus would be education, as well as support for law enforcement as they do their jobs, and the support for the first responders that they can get to a place to administer medications like naloxone when it's available and feasible.
Jennifer, anything you'd like to add?
I think that was perfect. I don't have anything to add. No.
Well, and if it was perfect, we're going to leave it at that.
Okay.
I want to thank you both for being here and being on the show. I appreciate everything you've said today. And I want to thank all the listeners for tuning in today. Please join me again next week when we will talk to the people on the front lines and those behind the scenes who make a difference in your life in Northumberland County. So please tune in. The impact of opioids on people is never so real as when we hear the stories from people who face this problem directly, or from the family and friends of those who have either lost someone to an opioid overdose or is trying to help a person facing an addiction to this drug. I am interested in your stories, and if you are willing to share your stories, please feel free to go to my Facebook page or to my own website and offer your story. Find any appropriate place to comment and write freely. Or you can email me directly at considerthisnorthumberland@gmail.com. We need to hear all the stories from many perspectives, so thank you. I would also like to thank all of you who continue to write thoughtful, caring, and insightful comments to my posts of the last weeks. Social media is not always a good place to debate issues, yet I am grateful to those who have demonstrated you can still have intelligent, considered, and caring discussions online. So thank you to all of you. If you have any comments, questions, rants, or raves, please email me at considerthisnorthumberland@gmail.com, or you can go to my Facebook page, Consider This. Or if you're on Twitter, you can message me at rwash. I will read out a selection of comments on next week's show. If you would like to listen or share this or any podcast, please check out my website at consider-this.ca. There you will find past podcasts, news, and other information about life and politics in Northumberland County. Or you can go to the radio station's website at northumberland897.ca. I'm Robert Washburn. Thanks for taking time out of your busy day to listen in, and I hope over the week you will continue to consider this.